Hello, listeners.
This is George.
This is Luke.
It's about buildings and cities.
And this, in a minute, you're going to hear a recording of our conversation recorded live at Nottingham Contemporary with us and Adam Caruso and an invited studio audience.
You'll mainly hear Adam because he spoke for most of the time, which is reasonable because all the people had turned up to listen to him. But we thought we might offer a bit of a corrective to that.
It's the first time we've done something like this. We were very flattered to be asked and did lots of preparation. We made what I thought was a very interesting slideshow counterposing the work of his studio, Caruso St. John, with various kind of provocative references drawn from the history of architecture. Unfortunately, we only got about 40% of the way through when time ran out.
Yeah, we'd been planning to do an hour and a half, and he insisted on doing an hour.
And in the end, we would probably have gone over that anyway.
We would have gone over that anyway.
So we're gonna play for you the recording, pretty minimally edited, which you're free to kind of listen through. We'll put a link to the presentation in the show notes, which you'll be able to download. And so you can sort of follow along. And then I think we'll also talk a little bit about what we didn't get to.
I'd like to talk about the whole thing. We'll see how it goes. I've got stuff I want to say.
Well, so join us. Picture the scene. You're in Nottingham.
It's a darkened and large room. There's a huge curtain behind us. And in fact, behind the curtain, there's an enormous amount more room. It being a multi-purpose space. Spotlight down. 3 mics on a table.
Yes, the sound of applause.
Hooray!
All right, good evening, everyone. I think I should just say something. We've already discussed with Adam the approach that we're going to take tonight, but just so that you're clued in, the approach, which might seem a little bit strange at first, is that we're going to be showing Adam the work of his own studio, but also interlaced with that, there will be a few other references, provocations of different sorts, intended to open up a little bit of context for our discussion around dimensions of the urban architectural design process, the relationship to history, and other things like that. I think as a starting point, I think we really have to begin in the building that we're in. And I wanted to start really just by asking in a quite open-ended way, returning to the building almost a decade after it was completed, what does it feel like? Are you surprised when you return to a project after that length of time? Are there kind of discoveries upon returning to it? Does it sort of work in the way that you imagined at the time that you were designing it?
It's not the first time I've been back since we finished it. So there isn't the possibility of enormous surprise. I think you make a project and it's an incredibly intense period when you're developing the project and then doing the drawings to build it and then build it. And in the case of this project, it was particularly intense but also enjoyable because it wasn't a normal architectural competition where you make a design. There was a small aspect of the submission which was a design, but it was actually a 90-minute interview, which was really more about one's attitude and the client trying to find an architect that would be able to work with them to define not just the architecture of the building, but also something about the program of the building. And for us, that was really exciting, and it was a fantastic process. I would say everything that we hoped the building could be, it's been that and much, much more. And the reason for that is, first of all, because of its program. I think, so a year and a half before the building opened, Alex Farquharson was appointed the first director, so we had to do a lot of work with people in and around the art scene in Nottingham before there was a director, before there was even an institution. And I think Alex had an amazing kind of curatorial idea about what Nottingham Contemporary could be, and that was an idea that was to do with the shows, but also to do with the program, to do with the ways in which the institution could engage, first of all, with Nottingham, but also nationally and internationally. And Alex was here for 5 years, I think, and then when Sam came, and I remember the first time I met Sam, he was saying, as the director, you immediately, your first assumption is you should change a lot of things, but actually the idea of not having monographic shows, of having thematic shows and two-person shows, he actually continued to do that, but obviously in another way. And the two shows I've seen, two or three shows that Sam has done, you know, they've been even more intense. So for me, when you do a public building, it's the program and it's the way in which the people who are conceiving of the program and the way in which that program engages with the different constituencies that, say, participate in a Kunsthalle building that Nottingham Contemporary is. That's the important thing. And that's the pleasure for me as an architect, is to come and see how the building is used or abused, the way in which people engage with the building. And, you know, what's so clear is that the program and the building have, and it's more the program than the building, but the building has enabled all different kinds of audiences to subscribe to what, you know, to what Nottingham Contemporary does, to subscribe and to participate and to contribute. And I also think the future of art institutions is that this contribution aspect has to become stronger and stronger, because I think the idea that one consumes art is already old-fashioned. And I think I could imagine Nottingham Contemporary is one of the places that could start to suggest ways in which that can happen. So it's always a pleasure, actually, because you think how well this institution is doing and that the building is playing a small part in that.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of had a follow-up, which was maybe pulling out a little bit. Obviously, one of the main ethical dimensions of architecture, which people often refer to, is its capacity within a kind of idea of city-making. So the sort of the urban results of an intervention at the scale of a building. Was that something which figured a lot in your thinking during the design of the building?
Yeah, a huge amount, and that was very contested, you know. Until the building opened, the local press and a number of politicians, and therefore a kind of buzz around the city, was that we were building a kind of concrete bunker, you know. And there were, I mean, I had to meet every member of the planning committee, and we got through planning quite easily because at the time it was a Labour majority in the committee, in the council and the committee, and they pushed it through. But I had some amazing conversations with politicians of every party. But the kind of more serious discussions were, why isn't it more glass, that somehow that would make it more open? And I said, but it's an art gallery. We need walls. And actually, we have some really big windows. And I think that the windows will be more important than having lots of glass. I said, glass, it's a kind of fiction of openness, but it's a deceit. It's a kind of capitalist deceit that you do lots of glass and it's open, but actually the glass is more opaque than masonry sometimes. And you know, because we do have this enormous window that looks out to Weekday Cross. We have the window that looks south from the offices and from the cafe, and the big opening at the entrance. And, I mean, of course, there were some people who understood that. But then, I mean, from the weekend of the opening, it completely changed. And people said, oh, it's not a concrete bunker. It's green. It has this lace. It's gold. It does have big windows. But it's also to do with the fact that the first shows used those openings. The program invited people in. But they're also, you're showing Garner Hill Steps. I mean, I don't know if any of you remember the site before the building. It was a hole filled with hypodermic needles, most of which was inaccessible. It was a really alarming place. I remember going onto the site with some kind of health kind of department of the city, you know, so we didn't step on needles. And it was very alarming. And we, this way through was something that existed before the hole was made for the railway. So like in 1900, Gardner Hill Step was a major north-south way to the lace market from the valley floor. And so there was a big urban idea in the project, and the idea that this way through and what was happening in the building, that those two things would be connected. And that's all true, and it all works. And I've been at openings where there's a huge grill on the lower yard, and you know, and it's kind of like it's riotous what's happening on the lower yard. And I, you know, today we had I had a chat with somebody who's in the audience at the top yard on the bench, you know. And so there are all these small, low-key social possibilities around the building and in the building, and that was always an idea. Because it's a contemporary art building, which isn't the first place that most people want to go. You know, so you need to make these places for people to hang out, and maybe it's raining and they're hanging out underneath the canopy and they think, oh, that show looks a bit scary. But maybe the week later they've been dreaming about it and they venture into the building and see the show. That was like one of my stories while we were selling the building to people, you know.
Does that urbanity also extend to the interior? Is there a kind of urban interior? Does that figure in your thinking?
Well, there's a kind of very challenging, when you're in the canopy, you look into the wind lobby and you look into the first gallery. And for a long time, the idea was that you would enter into the first gallery. And then the people we were working with from the city and me, we both decided that's probably too radical. You need a kind of a decompression space between the city and the galleries in order, as a visitor, to acclimatize yourself, but also as an artist, it's like it's just too much that every show is going to be entered through the gallery. Mm-hmm. And now it's a nice medium. So the current show, there's like a kind of peephole and there's a thing in the window. There's been other shows where you look right into the gallery because that works. And it's the same with the bay window. Some shows can broadcast out to the city, and other times the bay window is like a shop window and it's separate. And you know, one has to be reasonable. One doesn't want the gallery space to kind of be tyrannical instruments. I think art space has to be able to be used in lots of different ways. That's my feeling. Not all architects have that position, but that's my position. Yeah, but that's like a perfect, you know, that's what we imagined. That's what happened. The Nottingham Contemporary side, which is very late and something I'm quite proud of as a kind of piece. But I remember we had some discussions with the access officer of Nottingham saying, well, but it might be a bit exclusivist having the Nottingham Contemporary in mirror image. And I said, come on, you must be joking. I said, it's a joke, you know. And then we went and we said, but look, there's a piece of glass here and you look in the glass and it's the right way around. And and somehow I won that argument. We didn't win all of them, you know. But the whole point was that to have Nottingham Contemporary next to Nottingham Contemporary was such a stupid thing to do. So we were going to do it in a really stupid way. So it wasn't so stupid. But it's a great place to sit, you know, and wait for somebody. And those things which are about a public building, which I think are really important. And, you know, we designed the benches in the building too, and somebody's sitting on one in the picture. And I think that those things are really important in public buildings. Like, I go to galleries a lot, and I really like sitting down in them. It's very important to me. I don't like being exhausted. I like to be able to sit and look at something for a long time, or just look something up on my phone or read something or whatever. And that's part of what a public building offers, I think.
Yeah. Did you want to... No. I mean, I might go on. I wanted to ask, really, maybe for you to cast your mind back a little bit to when you were first sort of formulating your approach to the design of public buildings. So going back into the 90s when you were entering competitions and then eventually winning one for Walsall. And I was kind of thinking, I was trying to sort of think about what that discourse was like around that time. I had this quotation, this is from Rem Koolhaas's essay on the generic city, where he has this kind of ironic dystopian essay about how all the cities are becoming the same. They all have a waterfront district, whether or not there's any water there. They're in every time zone. There are three performances of the musical Cats. And then at the same time, there was also, I think, this quite strong faith in this idea of the iconic building, which is something that people talked about a lot. But the iconic building kind of affects the city that is in at the level of media or at the level of images rather than in a sort of a physical way.
That's one of the better
OMA. Yeah. This is one of his. And I was kind of wondering when you were starting to do that and when you were starting to work on this building, was that something which you felt you had a clear kind of polemic against?
Yes. I mean, there's two things. I mean, that quote by Koolhaas, it's like, that's pure Koolhaas. And I mean, there was a time when I was a world expert on Rem Koolhaas and OMA, and I used to go to the AA and do seminars with the graduate students, you know. And he was a big influence on us, but also I think he was a kind of negative that quite early on we decided to be the anti-Koolhaas. Because that quote is actually, what does it mean? You know, because Cats is playing all the time in London, is that why London is bad? Like, I've never seen Cats, I never will. It doesn't affect me if Cats is playing. I don't care, you know? And there's a lot of things wrong with London now. They're not to do with Cats. But yes, I moved to London in 85. It was, you know, the pomp of Margaret Thatcher, and we started our practice when she was just leaving for John Major, which was only slightly better, maybe. But we sort of thought about and formed what our practice would be about in the kind of dereliction of Thatcher's London. You know, so under Thatcher, there was a lot of investment in certain places, completely at the expense of other places. So our first office was in Peter's house on a mews in Islington. He still lives there. And we were looking at railway tracks and just at empty sites. And that's in Islington. You know, we weren't like in the far reaches of Hackney or something. And we really, really worked to find ways that we could look at that dereliction, this kind of late capitalist collateral damage, in a way, in a positive way. And the work of artists from the late 60s and early 70s, people like Matta Clark and Robert Smithson, the work of the Dusseldorf School of Photography, so people like Strutt and Gursky and Candida Hoffer, those people really helped us look at the city and find what was of value, even in this seemingly derelict place. And then we did this competition in Walsall where it's, you know, the dereliction of East London times 20. I mean, Walsall is really tough. There's been a series in The Guardian where John Harris goes and talks to people in Walsall. It's really quite something to see because I kind of know some of those places and I met people like that when we were doing the project. So the last thing Walsall ever needed was an art gallery. But because of the lottery, they could build one. And they had this amazing collection, the Garman Ryan collection. They had this extraordinary director, Peter Jenkinson, and he said, I can get the money to do an art gallery. There isn't money for a hospital or a school or whatever. We're going to do the art gallery, and we're going to make it the best. And we would have arguments with the Arts Council who would say, yeah, but it's in Walsall, so it should only be 60% of a London gallery in terms of budget and things. And he said, no, it should be 150%. It's Walsall. They need more. And that was an amazing kind of political journey to go on and to do lots of consultations with people. Walsall, it's also in the Midlands, like Nottingham, but it's very, very different. And to make a gallery that had some relevance, and that was the first public building of any significance they'd built since 1904 when they built their town hall. that was quite something. And then to answer your question, we were really, if we had any reputation at that time, and it was only, we won the competition 5 years after we started our practice, the reputation was to reject rhetoric, to reject grand gestures, to try to do things which are much more engaged and coming from the situation. And I think in many ways, Walsall is connected to its situation, but it's also a rhetorical building. And I remember we went to visit, and Peter and I were really shocked, you know. And we said, no, we've got to, this is going to be a 15 million pound building, and it's got to look like it's a 15 million pound, you know, it has to look like it's a 20 million pound building, because this place needs support. And the extraordinary thing is we could make a building that people in Walsall, and of course Peter Jenkson over 10 years had done this amazing job of engaging very non-conventional art populations into the gallery, and it became something that was a source of enormous pride for normal people, but also for the politicians who we had a lot of contact with, because they had to really push and take some risks in order to build the building. And, you know, there's been in the press last year that they couldn't afford to continue running it, and at the moment they can, but when you look at the state of Walsall now, after all the cuts, pretty soon they won't be able to, you know, and what's that about? It's not a comment on Walsall or on the idea of building this gallery. It's a comment on all sorts of other things. So it was rhetorical, intentionally.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a couple of things about this building because I think it's really interesting. We put the Brem Koolhaas, the Casa de Musica, which is a concert hall in Porto, in North Portugal, up. Not because they're particularly similar buildings, but they're both icons. And chose that one because it's a bit nicer than some of the earlier ones. Mm-hmm. But this feels to me like it's trying to be several. It's sort of lots of different things going on around being an icon.
Yeah.
It's like this sort of tower fortress in the town, which commands views around. But it also strikes me on this facade, which I think is really, one side's got a kind of even spread of windows, and one's got this very...
More even. Yeah.
And this one's got this very interesting, which I was thinking when you were talking about the train line, is this like those funny things you have on the other side of train lines, which is some Victorian building where they put a stair up and this, and you're.
But we were looking.
You're having
we were
clues
looking at
of
things like that.
What's inside?
Yeah. Yeah.
And they kind of. But also, you were talking about being drawn in by windows, and they're kind of questions. Why are they? They look intentional.
We had an idea that this terracotta cladding, which is very special, is like feathers or like a coat over the volume of the building, and then the windows are really placed according to the rooms, and the concept for the facade with these layers means you can move the windows around. But an extraordinary thing about these windows is that when it opened the building, people were then going up and looking for their houses, for where they worked along the canal. And, you know, anecdotally, we heard that when they'd have out-of-town family coming, they'd go to the gallery in order to go up to look at Walsall. And so this gallery was about looking at the exhibitions, but it was also about looking at the city again, which was never something we consciously thought of, but we did think that it was really important to have these windows to make the connection to the town, which, you know, had a lot of dereliction, but also, if one looked at it with the kind of privilege of, like, my privileged eyes, one could also see a kind of picturesque beauty. And what was amazing was that the windows and us saying it, and more importantly, the people in the gallery saying it, I think allowed some people to see the surroundings in a new way. That's quite amazing that a building can be a building obviously completely transforms the site it's made on, and this building does that too. It was a hole, and now it's a museum with a staircase. But it also has, it can become an instrument that also, when you're inside it, somehow affects the way you perceive what's around it.
Another kind of angle I wanted on it was that, I'm just going to skip through a couple. I thought it was kind of like a big
Yeah, well, that was one of our references. And Hartwick Hall. We called it a big house.
It's got a big staircase.
Yes,
it's got a big staircase. Yeah. It's got a big hall. Yeah. It's got a tower on top.
Yeah.
And it's also got some elements that took me a bit of looking at it, but I think it's got things about it which are quite grand domestic.
Yeah, that was the idea. Roof. We called it a big house. That was the name for the competition entry. A big house, and that it had this incredible variety of spaces, and that was it was a way of making a place for the Garman Ryan collection, which was a domestic collection. It was in Jacob Epstein and Kathleen Garman's house, and then it was also about that you could make something that was big, like Hartwick Hall, which is not far from Walsall and Lichfield, so it could be monumental, but it also could be domestic, you know. So something which moderates the monumentality. So it's not like a palace which is about power. It becomes a house for everybody in Walsall, you know, if one is going to take it to its the end, that analogy.
Can we go back to the... Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about... So this is the plan we're looking at here, and then this is the pub. Mm-hmm. And this between these sort of these different elements...
And the canal basin, it wasn't there, it was part of our project. Yeah, we designed that canal basin so that you had the space for the boats to turn around.
I mean, I'm kind of going back in time again, but the sort of urban assemblage of different elements was then summoning to mind this reference, which I think within a very restricted sort of North London circle is an extremely famous project. But
so it's the Half Moon Theatre by Florian Bagel, and I worked for Florian Bagel, and Peter worked for Florian Bagel, and I even saw a play before it was ruined. I saw Stephen Berkoff sink the Belgrano, you know, during the Falklands War in that theatre, and it was a kind of Brechtian theatre which was about politically engaged theatre on the Mile End Road in East London.
I mean, was there a sense... I sort of get the sense that there was a kind of a counterculture which was going on in and around
North London
and those kind of... I mean, is that right? And kind of, is that something which then fed into the practice and the project?
I've never heard it being called a counterculture, but certainly the example of Florian, who just died a couple of weeks ago... He was a major, major influence for Peter and I. And the other major influence was Tony Fretton, who was a more explicitly politically engaged person and a very important architect from the late 80s, I guess, making work that was really very unusual in the British scene, a work that was much more connected to European practice, very critical, and was a big influence, who taught Peter in first year and who we had a very uneasy but productive relationship. He was in the Walsall competition too. He came in second. He was very angry about that. We're friends now. We're friends now.
I was going to say uneasy how.
He almost punched me at an opening just after that. Yeah. He was a boxer. Big guy.
This is just a voluptuary. It's like,
but that's it. That's the idea of it, you know, and the colors and everything. But of course, you know, that warehouse isn't luxury anything. It's abandoned, you know. But it's beautiful, you know. If you have the right sunglasses on, everything can be quite beautiful. At least visually, it can be.
Yeah, there's no real question.
Yeah, so here, for instance, it's a small Monet of a view down a canal hung next to a window with a view down the canal, you know? So, yeah, a bit didactic, but it totally works, and it completely validates that view down the canal, you know? And this is a place where those things are important. It's quite magic, and, you know, that wasn't our idea. But the building enabled that to happen.
Yeah. So you can see a little bit of the scale of the spaces.
That's the Garman Ryan collection. Yeah.
I wondered if we could go on to talk a little bit about the Housemans. And your relationship to their work. So I think I've admitted this already, but I'd never heard of them at all before, mm-hmm. being asked to do this in conversation, but you'd known their work from a little
while
back.
Well, I have the fortune to. I'm a frequent. I live half the time in Switzerland, so they're marginal figures in the Swiss scene, but amongst, you know, certain cognoscenti, they're important. They are of a generation, quite an important generation, of Swiss architects who built a lot from the late 70s. You know, the generation of Richard Rogers and Foster, and who were doing, there's a few people who did sort of high tech, this guy, Theo Hutz, but otherwise doing kind of modernism. And tricks, I mean, Robert is a furniture maker. He has a kind of design background, but Trix Hausmann, she's an architect. She went to the ETH, where I teach now. And so that was their circle. And they did collaborations with those architects, and then there was this turn, and they kind of had more of an alignment with the art world, with people like Memphis and kind of northern Italian scene, which had some connections to things happening in Switzerland. And they started to do interiors. They did a few houses, furniture, and furniture that's much more art works. And I guess I knew people who knew of them. There's a few bars that they did which are still around, and one goes to them. And then Freddie and Niels, who curated the show here, who've really championed them for the last 10 or 12 years and sort of positioned them back into the art world, they're the curators at the school I teach at. And we know each other quite well because I'm involved in the exhibition program there. So, yeah, and while we were doing the show, I met them for the first time, which I don't normally like meeting old architects or artists because they tend to be very grumpy. But the Hausmanns are not grumpy. They're full of energy and enthusiasm, and they're quite extraordinary people, very open still. And we went to have a little apero at their flat, and we stayed for like 3.5 hours. And it was, I had to do this special Hans Arp game of chance for tricks, and she photographed it. And like, we had to do lots of things there before I was allowed to leave. It was amazing. And yeah, so it was really fun to do the show here and to do it with Niels and Freddie. And so now I just had a meeting last night with Niels and Freddie in Zurich about the show is going to be at the school in November, and how we're going to install it in the gallery, which is in the school. And probably I'll have a conversation with them then. So I'm not an expert, but obviously I'm interested in things which are slightly beyond good taste. It's always been a mission of mine to rescue architecture and design from good taste. And the Hausmanns, that's clearly been their life's work to do that.
Oh. Yeah, I think I'm not sure it's so bad.
Yeah,
I didn't say it was so bad, but it's not conventionally. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing easier than good taste.
I mean, this quotation, which I think is Robert Hausmann's, it's sort of interesting to what the nature of this rewriting is, and often the rewriting is in this very layered, very kind of witty, ironic way. So I thought it would be interesting just to make very explicitly the comparison between their work here with these mirrors and this sort of original reference in the Palazzo Te by Giulio Romano. But so the joke is that the stones have become mirrors. These voids, these mirrors, and also that the sort of very expressed rusticated edge has become this ready-made of the frame around it. And I mean,
this is the most classic mannerist move, to break columns, because columns are strong and support things and don't and mustn't break.
Yeah, but it's sort of to break it in the language almost of kind of machines or robotics, of this sort of horizontal
precision. It's also a take on certain Italian furniture from just before when they did it. So, I mean, so it's a double joke.
Here's some nice mannerist broken columns.
Yeah.
It's also in the
Palazzo Te. Yeah.
But it's doing something similar, because it's a building, this is a room that's completely, like, it's just surface. The surface wraps around there's no articulation at all, except that it's a room which is full of crashing down.
Although
on you.
That's how you made interiors in those days. So, you know, most of Palladio's villas, there the interiors are spaces waiting to be painted. And that was the expectation. And the painters of the villas got paid a much higher fee than the architects of the villas.
Or were the same people in a couple of cases.
No, but not in Palladio's
no,
villas.
Not in Palladio.
I mean, and there were some painters who he liked to work with, and then there were others who, like, over-gilded the lily, you know. But of course, what... I mean, in this case, he was the painter and the architect, and he's obviously pushing it. Yeah, and I think it was a setting for lots of very debauched goings on, so it was very programmatic.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see these sorts of material inversions, the sort of, heavy becoming light, or the robust becoming fragile, these sorts of things going on. I mean,
it got me, this one. I thought it was brass when I first saw it.
What? The
curtain.
Chair. But the curtain is by... Petra Blaise, you know, it's not by them. It's a curtain that's always in the gallery at the ETH, and it's visiting Nottingham at the moment.
Right.
So okay. She did it specially for the gallery. But of course it goes.
Yeah. I mean, do you really get something out of these kind of little twists on materiality or these sorts of ironizations? Is that one of the things which you're...
I don't think that's a word.
Definitely a word.
No. We do it in our work. Okay, so you have it. I mean, so it's exactly like that, isn't it? And the history of architecture is the history of things metamorphosing into other things. That is what architecture is. And there's different theories of architecture, but like there's a guy, Gottfried Semper, who in the second half of the 19th century put forward a whole theory of clothing, a kind of analogy with clothing, and so that the architecture is not the thing that's actually holding up the roof. The architecture is the clothing which is concealing, but also in some way referring to the structure which is holding up the roof and the walls, etc. And he was a neo-Renaissance architect, and so he was referring to things from the Renaissance and the Mannerist period, which you were showing before, and so you know, the facades of this building. We were interested in this idea of lace, but we were also interested in architecture by people like Louis Sullivan, who were making these incredibly developed facades in the late 19th century with terracotta. But we didn't make it in terracotta because in the 19th century, terracotta was a cheap material, and that was already a critique of carving in stone. But to make a very elaborate terracotta facade today would just be very expensive. But to make it in precast concrete actually was having the kind of economy that Sullivan was achieving in the late 19th century. So it's again having certain ideas about ornament and about articulation of surface and also referring to things, the lace market, but using a contemporary means of production, which means it's efficient. Because I think when you do something which is really tortured, that's possible, I think, to do at the scale of furniture and an interior. That's justifiable. But I think when you're making a building, you do need to have an economy, an actual economy, but also an intellectual economy in what you're doing. Otherwise, it just becomes pathetic in a way.
Do you think that concrete also, though, rams it home even harder with lace? Lace, this stuff close to your skin.
Yeah.
These
possibly.
Concrete that's so
and,
heavy.
You know, and in the end, it took us like a year to figure out how to do this. But it is extraordinary how delicate the impression on the precast is. And the other thing is that modern precast is not like 1960s precast. It's much denser. And that's why the building still looks okay after 10 years. It doesn't stain. It doesn't absorb lots of stuff. I mean, also the environment is much cleaner now than it was in the 50s and 60s, but it's has the density of a sandstone, say, whereas 1960s precast was much more porous and much more liable to get stained and to have different kinds of failure.
Yeah, I mean, I wondered if we could take the kind of thought into an ongoing project. And so this is the Zurich Lions ice hockey
arena. Yeah,
and so what are we looking at here? Because this is just a little fragment of something, isn't it?
We're looking at a car crash, I guess. it's a detail of the facade, and I think you have a drawing of the facade after. And so this is an ice hockey arena for 1,200 people, so it's quite a bit bigger than this building. So that's the long facade, which is 180 meters long, and the short facades are 90 meters long, and that's a detail of that.
And it's really big.
It's really big, and initially it was going to be made in precast concrete as well, but for a number of reasons, cost savings, one of them, but it's also, it makes it much more powerful. The facades are going to be made entirely of in-situ concrete, so they're going to be cast on-site. And that's a first prototype. It's 3 meters high, that prototype. That's in-situ concrete made with the same rubber molds that the facades here were made, but the molds will be on-site. There's 60 different molds are required to make the building, and the contractor is in the process of doing now a 14-meter high prototype to see how the two lifts, how the joint between the two lifts will look. And it's amazing the client agreed to do it, because it's obviously more risky to do it in situ, but it's also more thrilling.
And that's partly because if you were casting off-site, you'd be able to cast with the decorative face on the bottom of the mold.
It's that, but it's also that you would be making smaller elements and there's repetition and you're indoors. When you're doing it outside, there's all sorts of other variables. But the reason we did it was that by doing it in situ, the facade is structural, so we could eliminate a whole other layer of concrete on the inside. Because it's a hockey arena, insulation in most of it is not as big an issue, because the main space of the arena is not insulated. The foyers are not insulated. Only 20% of this building is insulated. And because of that, it meant that you could have an external facade which is continuously connected with the horizontal structures, and it could be working. And so it's like one of these things where a number of things come together. So the energy use in the materials of the building are greatly reduced by doing it this way. So it's all these lucky things coming together.
And it'll be really cool.
No, yeah. Of course.
It's like wobbly.
It's like a dam. Like the only analogy we can think of in terms of in situ pores is a dam, which they have a lot of in Switzerland. And yeah, it's going to be kind of a thrilling thing to cast it.
Is this contradiction, though, this kind of billowing fabric in complete, I mean, is that part of the enjoyment of the...
Totally.
Yeah,
totally,
just, yes, yeah. This tension and, or something. I mean, when you come up with something like that, do you think, you know...
And that's really interesting because, you know, in the competition, it was precast. The first 2 years of working on the project, developing the design, it was precast. And then we work with this amazing structural engineer, Patrick Gartman, on all of our projects in Switzerland. He first trained as a architect, then as an engineer. He is really special. And there's some projects where he has a huge, he makes a huge contribution. And he loves in-situ concrete. And he was calculating, saying, well, we can save 4 million Swiss francs by going to the precast. And then there were all these other advantages. And yes, it's like the project, which, you know, the design of the facade we'd done, but then by transforming the way you make it, it becomes even more powerful. And that's just one of the reasons you bother designing and making buildings, you know, because of these discoveries. And it's so much more powerful as an in-situ construction. Yeah.
Not the first time it's happened. This is much smaller and a bit older. V&A Museum of Childhood. Those stones are, they go all the way through. They're holding up the wall.
Well, they're 75 millimeters, but they hold themselves up, yes. Yeah. Like a traditional stone facade.
Yeah, I was kind of interested about, was this a moment in your career where you were doing, like, had you done something as explicitly sort of historicist or with as explicitly kind of decorative a metaphor as this before?
No, and I think when we finished this building, which is a building we're proud of and which might be altered in a rather horrible way soon, but...
well, we're going to ask you.
We'll, no, I don't want to talk about it, but it was... The reception was very, very mixed. I think young architects really enjoyed it. It's very decorative, but it also is completely flat, you know, so it has qualities of conceptual art, like completely surface. There's no depth to anything. And then it has this pattern which comes from early Renaissance buildings, Italian buildings, which are illusionistic and which in themselves have a depth, but there is no depth. And I think lots of British architects hated this building, you know, because they thought it was pastiche. But I don't think it's pastiche because the technique and the image of the building are there's something quite tense about the two of them, in the same way as we were talking about with the arena, you know. And originally we didn't want the stone to be self-supporting. The idea was that it was going to be really, really thin, but actually that introduced other problems, so we made it self-supporting.
Do you think we're finding ways to do ornament, and it be contemporary? Is that what this is?
Yeah, but why not? I mean, yeah. I'm not that, you know, at the moment I'm not so... but go to Majolica, you know. So that's by Otto Wagner. It's at the turn of the century, and it's this amazing... and a very important Viennese architect who was very important in the development of modern Vienna, but important as a teacher and important as an amazing building architect. And this is him going from a more classical position, being his students started the secession at this time in Vienna, and the secession was like the first group of artists who were rejecting classicism and traditional art. And it was him joining the younger generation in the secession. So he really supported them, and then he joined them. And so this is a kind of secessionist or Jugendstil architecture, and it's using fire-tiled cladding with these amazing floral patterns. These are made, they're made in... in Hungary by a porcelain factory, and they were patterns that were designed by Wagner and other members of the secession, but they were then available. Yeah, so they were industrially produced. This was a kind of cheap facade. Mm-hmm. So this was very innovative, and the decorative theme was also very innovative because it's not classicist, it's not Gothic either, it's this kind of new decorative language, which is to do with nature and growth and change, and kind of at the same time as Frank Lloyd Wright is doing the same thing in the States. So, you know, I think ornament is always possible when the way you make it and the image of the ornament, there is a kind of a tense tension between the two. I think if you today make a building and you carve it in stone, and the stone is massive, and it costs tens of millions of pounds, which, and there's buildings like that being built in Britain now for very rich clients, then I don't think it's relevant. Because I don't think people like Wagner or Plechnik or all of those people would think for a second to work in that way. But I also don't think necessarily they would say ornament is irrelevant anymore. Because I think... you know, ornament, you don't need. I mean, the projects we're doing now in the office are not terribly engaged with ornament. I think you make decisions now about what your architecture is going to be about, but I think also everything is available to you now.
Yeah, I think it's really crucial that this is using but sort of subverting the industrial economy of its day, which is set up to build tons and tons of Viennese, more conventional sort of post, you know, and... this is water jet cutting, I guess. Of yes, stone,
it,
must
there's,
be.
There's no, the only hand stuff in Museum of Childhood is the laying of it, you know, but the stuff is all water cut, and that's driven by, I mean, it didn't have to be, it's so simple there, but on other of our projects, it's driven by two or three dimensional computer models that we produce, which are more and more directly connected to manufacturing. And so that's a big potential now, and it's something we're completely engaged in. And so there's nothing nostalgic or backwards looking about doing things which are elaborated, but I think one can do projects that are not elaborated. I don't think, I'm not here to say all buildings should have super elaborated facades or interiors or whatever. I think it's to do with what's relevant in each situation, and it's also about what you decide to do in each situation.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to ask a little bit about the, to press the point a little bit in the digital direction. I mean, there was a sort of slight shudder ran through you when you saw this.
Yeah, well, I want to say I think that this is not an appropriate and interesting subversion of an industrial technique. I think it's exactly what the industrial technique is. What's so interesting about the Majolica House for me is that it's such a radical departure, and yet it's still appropriate.
But also this kind of tracery on the outside of the building is the building in Paris, isn't it? I think it's sort of vaguely looking at Art Nouveau and Guimard and stuff, but all of that stuff's completely useless. It's you don't need it, and that's the other thing. And I can't believe it when clients pay or architects propose things where you can completely remove the thing, and it would make no difference to the performance of the building. It's not shading those windows, you know. So that's the other thing I think is a problem. Well, and then the way it's made is completely stupid. You know?
Well, talking of a thing which is just a thing.
I mean, this sort of relationship again of flatness, surface, and also digital process going on here as well.
This is a
new chancel for the Cathedral St. Gallen that we did. It was finished a couple of years ago, so it's a very special place, and it was commissioned to replace a provisional altar that was done in the mid-60s in response to Vatican II, and they had a jubileum for the 1400th year of Gallus coming from Ireland and bringing Christianity to Switzerland. It was a not inconsiderable event. So we won a competition to do this new altar, and it had to be special, you know, and we did the competition, we won, and then we didn't know how special, like it was almost impossible to do what we proposed. Even though in the Renaissance we knew lots of examples of things that were as complex. But like if you go back to the steps, I won't dwell on it, but you know, the chancel is built on these steps. Each one is elliptical, so the steps are changing dimension everywhere. And in order to do three-dimensional shapes in inlaid stone, it's very difficult. And actually, those couldn't be driven by any computer modeling. Those had to be drawn by us, and then they were hand-carved. Because if we used three- or five-axis milling, it wasn't accurate enough. So all the two-dimensional stuff was water jet cut, which is simple, but all of the three-dimensional stuff had to be done by hand, and the mason who did it, who was amazing, had to invent machines to polish the terrazzo and the stone. In a cathedral, where you're doing something to last for hundreds and hundreds of years, that's justified. It's not that expensive. It's a small project. But that would not be justified in other situations, you know. I'm not particularly religious, but this is at the center of a very important cathedral, which is a World Heritage Site and the UNESCO Register, etc., etc. A perfect Rococo cathedral, yeah. And you're making a new piece in it. And we made a crucifix.
Yeah, yeah. Is that the fun of this kind of project? This sort of getting
well, we
to
were
do
waiting
things,
to know. I mean, of course, cathedrals have hundreds and hundreds of crucifixes. And there was a new cathedral priest who joined in the last few months before the consecration, and he said, "We need a new crucifix for the consecration. We can't use one of the old ones." And we said, oh, we never thought you'd ask, but you've waited a bit long and to ask. And I think in the last 2 months, we had to design and make the cross, which is in gold leaf and which takes attributes. St. Gallen has the most famous Christian library with illuminated manuscripts from the early church. And so we looked in some of those manuscripts and we picked attributes for the apostles and Christ from it. So that's what's on the front. It has Christ and three apostles, and we chose it with the head of liturgy. And on the back, there's Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. And it's a Greek cross. And it was super interesting to discuss all of those things with the priest and with the head of liturgy, who were very impressive people. And
could
that's the bishop's throne, which is carved out of a single olive tree.
Oh, yes. So many nice
that's
things.
That's the sorts of things you need to do when you're working in a cathedral.
I wanted to ask about the terrazzo. It comes up a lot in your projects. It's
not
something that, if you thought about it generally, I mean, it's amazing here. It's like a rock. There's a lot of rocks in Christianity.
Yes.
And it seems like something which is kind of a cut through, or it's a single material.
Do people know what terrazzo is? Cement that has aggregate. It's concrete in a way, but you put special aggregate and then you polish it in situ. In this country, in the 50s, it was used a lot, but in, say, the German, in Venice, or in Venice in the 14th, 15th century, it was used everywhere because it could accommodate movement. Because Venetian buildings move because they're built on wooden piles in the water. And in Germany, from the middle of the 19th century, really all public buildings used terrazzo. It was a kind of Kunststein, like a cultured stone, and they were very interested in it. And so there's a real technique. But actually the mason who made it, and that's him with the green shirt, Urs Schmidt, he's a second generation mason. He'd never done terrazzo, and his first prototypes were terrible. And then he went to Portugal and he got two guys who knew about terrazzo and they made it. And he went to Carrara and chose the stone to make the aggregate from. So the aggregate was specially made for this terrazzo. We wanted very big pieces that were very close together. We also, the high altar has an enormous piece of Thasos marble, solid, 4 meters wide on it. So he had to go there anyways for that. And it's an amazing thing to do. We're now making a giant piece of furniture for Canterbury Cathedral, which is equally amazing, a single piece of furniture to hold the console for the new organ next to the choir, and we've been working for 4 years on that, and it's being built next month in the cathedral. Those are such magic things to do.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to sort of pursue the line of surface maybe into the territory of like a kind of an urban surface or a surface which creates urban space. I'm conscious of time,
yeah,
so we can go through this quite quickly. I could talk about this for a long time because there are these very beautiful sort of symphonies of grey and things. I just wanted to ask a little bit about this because it's not a building. I mean, it's part of it. And then I was also sort of wondering about what it was and what it was meant to be, whether what we're looking at is sort of a drawing or a painting like Berlin Marx's schemes in Rio, or if it's...
Or like a memory? Or
well, if you go back, I mean, it's also on the cathedral scene. So there's an enormous... This is in Kalmar in the south of Sweden, and it's the cathedral square in the middle of a Baroque extension to a city. So it was all built in the 16th century. And the cathedral's by Thyssen the Elder, who also did, I think, the beginning of the Royal Palace in Stockholm, very important architect. And if you go back, so on the, there, so this was sort of the first square in this town, and it was made with these field stones, which are, it's a glacial moraines all around this part of Sweden, and these are stones from the glacial deposit. And we made up this story when we did the competition, which was that in order to make the fields around the town arable. They had to remove these stones, and they made walls out of the stones, which is true. And then when they were urbanizing, they took the stones from these walls, they're dry walls, dry stone walls, and they brought them to the center of the town, and they made the square. It's true, that story, but it's also a really good story. And they organized the stones, so they have their field stones, and then they use larger ones to make lines, and that defines the structure of the market, which takes place two or three times a week. And our project was really like a carbon, a neutral energy project. And I also talked about Joseph Beuys. And so it was about removing all of the stones that came from the 20th century, which were marking roads and curbs and things like that. And we used those stones to make other streets elsewhere in the center of the town. And then in the square, we used the existing stones. We found some new ones to extend the square. And then these ones, which are, they're called cat skulls, which were the first cut stones, which were just for one street. And we used them to make these different squares outside the cathedral, outside the town square. And then the last thing was, then there's one smooth path, which are big precast blocks which use the smallest aggregate so you can cycle along it and go with the wheelchair and things like that. And so it was this whole amazing mythology. We worked with an artist, Eva Lufdahl, a Swedish conceptual artist, it was amazing. So it was very narrative, the project, but actually the material was all actually from that space or from just outside the town, outside the center of the town. And it made the people and the politicians kind of be aware of these field stones, which they'd never noticed before. And at the opening, we had a dinner, and all of the guests got their field stone with their name on it. And there were some people dressed up as field stones dancing. You know, so this idea of the field stones, which they'd never thought of, became a kind of a symbol for Kalmar. And I remember the mayor asking me, but don't other towns have these field stones? I said, I don't think so. Not field stones like this. They don't have
right.
them. And he was super happy about that.
So
I don't know if that's true, but...
I mean, so, yeah, in terms of what I want to talk about, I would like to spend a bit of time talking about this project, which is the Bremer Landsbank, which finished a couple of years ago, and which has lots and lots of elements and lots of potential dimensions. So
it's also in a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's our specialty, working in UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Yeah, so you can see...
It's very easy.
Right.
That's why we do it.
And it's kind of... It's synthesizing an awful lot of references. We've got this brick architecture, which is...
Hanseatic.
Like, yeah. We've got...
Do you know that King's Lynn was a Hanseatic port? It was part of the Hanseatic League. Quite interesting, because this summer we went on holiday to the north of Germany and we visited a number of Hanseatic ports. Lübeck was the central one, and King's Lynn was part of the League. And it was a kind of toll-free network for trade, like the EU.
Yeah, so I mean, we're looking here at all of these...
Cuts, plan details. Yeah, of this very, very elaborate facade.
Yeah.
Which is self-supporting brick. And the bricks are made in Bremen by a kind of old brickmaker. Yeah.
And the project is, it's got lots of different, I mean, it's a big building and it's got lots of sort of dimensions and things. There is, I mean, we're seeing the brick engineering coming in also and becoming an interior condition here.
So that's
the
banking hall on the... It's on the cathedral square. So it's next to the cathedral. And it's... the whole square is... I don't know if you've been... The center of Bremen is quite extraordinary. It's a network of three connected urban spaces with the cathedral, with St. Peter's Church, with the town hall, which has... three or four parts starting in the 15th century, 19th, 20th century, and then a 50s, very fine 50s building, and then it has the guild halls and all of those things. It's an extraordinary urban ensemble, really surprising. And the bank is like in and amongst that. So it's a very loaded site. And it's the Bremer Landes Bank, so it's the local, it's like a building society, kind of. And they were in a 1980s building which didn't work and was really terrible. So that's why there was this new building on the square.
The building is also sort of an ensemble, isn't it? There's sort of a bit behind this old facade.
That's the original bank, and then there's a 30s part of the bank, and then our part.
Yeah. And which is then kind of unified by this courtyard, and which has this view through here. But then there's also this kind of dimension that it's kind of synthesizing quite a lot of ideas from the broader architecture of Northern Europe. So I think that there's this reference in the courtyard, possibly to the architecture of Sigurd Leverenz.
It's exactly the same, yes.
So this is a building in Stockholm.
This is a building by Leverenz from the 20s. It's the social security offices. And it's when we're doing the competition, we found that, and because we were worried about the proportion of the width to the height, and it's very similar. Ours is a bit taller. And so, yeah, it was a direct copy.
How do you feel about this? It's a really interesting building that's got this old facade on one side. You're creating a new facade that's also sort of old in its bricky Hanseaticness. And then there's a...
Yeah, but when you're there, you know, the facade
yard in the
doesn't,
middle.
Doesn't look old. Although I think most of the people in Bremen can't remember what was there before, which is, as an architect, it's very popular, the building.
A lot of people take black and white pictures and sort of make it like the street scenes. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you know, it's interesting that you could make a building now. And I think if you look carefully at the facade, there's things that are quite uncanny about it and totally different than a 1920s facade. But at another glance, it takes its place amongst the ensemble at the center of the city. And that's interesting. You know, I think you don't do things to be original. You do things well, you know, and then it's what I was saying before, that the technique and the image of the thing have to be commensurate. They have to connect to each other. And, you know, this building, the facades are quite expensive, yes, but the total budget of the building is totally normal. So the normal office space is quite basic and functional, and there's a few representational interiors. The courtyard facade is very normal. It's stucco on a holding layer with insulation, etc. And so it's all made with contemporary construction techniques, you know, and I think that's very important. So it's not it's not a fantasy, it's real.
Yeah.
And when you see the facade, there's aspects of it that have a kind of physical brutality that are very different, which are maybe like those 1920s buildings felt like in the 20s, because they were like a German version of America. That was the intention of those buildings.
Yeah.
And
I mean, within that sort of, maybe certainly within the kind of architectural design theory of the past, there was this idea of composition, in the sense that the building would be composed of, you would consider your design as something which is about taking lots of different parts of the past and then synthesizing them. We were looking at this obviously not like your architecture. This is
but we did
bought the Guild building around the corner from here. But the idea that is that something which features sort of explicitly in the way you talk about design process?
You know, there's a myth, a kind of modernist myth, and it was almost never true. But lots of architects subscribe to it now. That, you know, you make a plan or you have a concept, and the concept is like an engine which informs everything. And it's not possible. You can't design a building that has one idea that informs everything. I don't think you can even design a piece of furniture that way. So you have to have composition. And there's many different ways. That's a very picturesque composition. It's a hilarious building in a good way. It has like 150% of the ideas it needs for its size, but it's really enjoyable, isn't it? And it's, you know, it's very clear what it's based on. It's based on a kind of arts and crafts architecture, which is a kind of architecture I love because of its purposefulness and its ability to negotiate different situations. And yes, great architects in the 19th century and even in the 20th century, they knew which currency and order to use for which project. That was part of the knowledge of an architect. And I still think it can be part of the knowledge. Part of the capacity that an architect has.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little. Maybe
we should really finish.
Yeah, do you want to? Should we do
one last thing? Because just in case. There's...
Okay, maybe can we do one last thing, which is the next one I was going to talk about, which is another sort of assemblage of parts, but with this other dimension that the parts are maybe trying to be kind of types or almost interested in being unexceptional. And you've spoken, I read your introduction to this, which is one of your historical books, in which you speak approvingly of the architecture of this architect, Fernand Pouillon, who's a post-war French architect. You speak of it drawing its strength from its banality. And I'd be really interested to know what banality is for you or what kind of the strength of banality can be in architecture.
Yeah, that's a long... Go back to Newport Street. But,
yeah.
Because I'm not going to talk about Pouillon. I could, obviously, but I'm not going to. But like, what's interesting about Newport Street is we did that project. It was in the office. It overlapped with Bremen. And they're both brick buildings in brick cities. But Newport Street is a kind of quite radical restructuring and then addition to three Victorian scenery painting workshops, which were really built in the cheapest and shittiest way possible. Yeah, so this is London industrial architecture, where every week they would go to the canal and see what bricks were available and buy the bricks. So there's five different kinds of bricks used in the existing building. So when we were choosing what bricks to build the new parts in, it was quite challenging. And we had lots of ideas and experiments, and we did something. I don't have to go into that. But, you know, this is a brick building. The existing buildings, obviously, the brick is the structure. The new buildings, the brick is self-supporting as well. The reason we always do that is if you don't have a self-supporting brick structure, you need silicon movement joints every 6 or 8 meters. And that's not so nice. And sometimes you have to do that. But with this building and the size of it, by making it hold its own weight down to the foundations, you didn't need to have expansion joints, which the old building didn't have. But here we're making a brick facade which is like next to the shittiest brick facade you can imagine. You know, it's not that cheap either, but that was the judgment that we were making. So, you know, we were looking at something which was the height of banality when it was made. But of course, it has other things which are generous and unusual and interesting. And we were trying to exaggerate those things in our project. And in Bremen, we were making a brick facade which was really at the edges of what our imaginations could support in terms of elaboration. I mean, we had reviews on that facade, I remember, where it was really like, you know, do we know what we're doing? Is this under control? But it clearly it was, because we could build it, you know. But it was really on the edge of how much can you elaborate something. And this is the opposite. This is something where there is almost no expression in the brick. The openings are just holes, and it somehow has to work as an ensemble with these other buildings. Yeah.
So should we skip to the end? Should we skip to dessert, or should we skip to free space?
Oh, but we could also have some questions. Why don't you just show free space?
Just
do,
yeah.
Okay, so this is...
Here's all of the other slides.
Yeah.
There's some good ones. Oh, you missed some good ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So,
That's the British... that's the British Pavilion in Venice, where you could go now and have a free cup of verbena tea. Because that's the only thing we were allowed to serve in the Biennale. Because they have a catering contract with the company, but you can get some free tea.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to troll you with this quotation, which I think sort of reveals the polemical nature of the project by the nature of the response to this.
Did
you
come across this one? This was Patrick Schumacher.
Yeah.
Self-indulgent. Quite something that he was calling us self-indulgent. I saw him up there. I didn't say hello.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, I think free space is...
He's opinionated, and he has to keep that reputation up. You know?
Yeah. If you ever want to get into a flame war on the internet...
Yeah. He will respond in the comments.
I have better things to do.
Okay.
Oh, that was for everyone.
Yeah. So I think free space is really the place to try and open things out to
it
questions.
Would be nice
thank
if
you
there
very
were
much.
Some questions. Maybe.
So was this your first time working on designing an exhibition within a gallery space that you've also designed? And what was that like, especially with your knowledge of the Housemans and your connection with them and even seeing inside their flat and stuff?
It's not the first time. Sorry. But I haven't done it that many times. We did a Picasso show at Gagosian Grosvenor Hill last year. But Picasso wasn't alive for that one. But we were working with John Richardson, who is Picasso's biographer, and that was so it was quite special in a kind of slightly similar way. It was much more difficult. I mean, I think designing a show in your own space, it doesn't make any difference, actually. Designing a show is always about an exhibition. I like designing exhibitions, you know, because they're fast, and curators... I only like designing exhibitions with curators who I want to spend time with, yeah, because the alternative is like hell. So, but generally it works out, and it is like taking a course, you know. It's like you get totally embedded in this subject, and you work with somebody who's probably worked for 2 or 3 years before on the show and has this incredible knowledge, but then the spatial organization of the show can affect the curating of the show. I mean, with the Hausmann thing, that wasn't the case because it was already at Kunstwerk in Berlin, but we added some stuff for the show here. But I'm working on 2 exhibitions now, and they're like for in 2 years' time, and it's amazing. It's really like taking a course, but you're the student, but you're also teaching it, you know, and that's really fantastic. But it doesn't, I think, you know, an exhibition design, the important thing about exhibition design is always that you're reconciling the space and the curatorial ideas of the show. And you want to show you want to make sure that the work is as powerful as possible in the space, and that usually in not an overly didactic way, the kind of curatorial impetus of the show is served, you know? And this show was super easy because Freddie and Niels are so easy to work with, and I think the relationship between Nottingham Contemporary and them, it was just fun, you know, and quick. When you do a show for 2 years, it's something else. It's not quick. But then you really can affect the objects in the show, you know, and you really have discussions about how to best convey the story of the show. And that's another... For me, it's so interesting. And also to do architecture that's only there for 2 or 3 months, that like the Biennale, that's really also nice. You know, you don't need to worry about lots and lots of things, you know, and you can be a bit risky. And that's the other nice thing with exhibition. I mean, if you have a good relationship with the curators, you know, the sense of risk, and it's only there for 2 or 3 months, and let's go for it, let's try. What's the worst thing that can happen? Some institutions, they don't take that view, unfortunately. But, yeah, I've managed to avoid that usually. So it's, you know. But I must say, they're really amazing spaces to install work in. They're really well done. Really well designed. No other questions? Oh, well. So we can carry on.
Yeah.
First a comment, but it's leading up to a question. I love this building, and I remember the comments about it and was delighted to see. And it seems to me that it fits what I call the fractal principle of good art, where it's the opposite of what Toulouse-Lautrec said about something, where he said there's less in this than meets the eye. And it's this idea of, as you get nearer to it, there's more to it. And it's what I love about the building, that you've got the boldness, you've got the large sculpture, but then as you get closer to it, you get the sculpture and you get the lace and so on. And it's been fascinating to hear how you achieved that and made it more modern. So I wanted to praise you for that and say how much you love it. But the question I wanted to lead on to is, I'm very much aware of where the building is, that it's on the Great Central Line. The Great Central Line was built to continental loading gauge and could have been HS2, and was intended to be HS2. And we could have had it coming through here. So what I wanted to ask was, did you have any issues with building it on there and being at the entrance to a tunnel, or were there opportunities that you were able to take from that? And affecting the building?
There were many challenges, yes. I mean, you know, the council's, the city's contribution to the capital costs were the site. And you wonder if the site was a kind of plus or a minus, because it was a hole. The fact it was a hole wasn't such a problem. There were opportunities, the kind of, the section of the building obviously takes advantage of that. There's like 13 meters difference from where the loading bay is and the entrance at the top. But there was a huge district heating pipe that goes on this site, which kind of in a very expedient way in the 70s was just dropped in the hole when the railway was stopped. So it had already been used, the tunnel. And that was really, really difficult. And it cost, I can't remember, like $1.5 million to deal with that. So there were huge challenges in the site and the difficulty of the site and a kind of, but nothing that couldn't be, you know, overcome. I mean, with none, you know, building buildings isn't rocket science, you know, that it's statics and it has to stand up. And, you know, there's also all these sandstone caves everywhere. And so there's that as well. So there were challenges, yeah. But there was huge opportunities, I think, with the change in level, with the fact that as soon as we looked at the old plans of the site, that Garner's Hill steps was really an important way, which had just been obliterated over time. And so there were these things that were great potentials, but also things that were very... which you could use to talk about the building, you know, and it was, they were accessible, people could understand them. And that's really important too, because obviously our job is to imagine what the building could be. Your client over time also understands it, although sometimes not as well as you think they do. But, you know, the general public and politicians, I don't assume there's no, you know, why should people be able to read drawings or read even renderings and stuff? And so you do have to find all sorts of ways to communicate with people. I think it's really important. And so some of the urban moves were things that I thought were very important and things that were accessible and which were clearly benefits to doing the building, you know? Because contemporary art doesn't convince everybody, you know, as a reason to do something. Although I think it's super important, you know? I think it's... If contemporary artists were more powerful, you know, in our politic nowadays, I think we would be in much better shape than the people who are in politics. Yeah.
Does it work? Yes. Okay. We don't see so many sketches.
This work? Yes. Okay. Hi. We don't see so many sketches, hand sketches, drawings. The work is obviously about making, you know, very much into materials. How do you evolve an idea in your practice? Is it about text?
I can describe it. I mean, I'm models? Of course.
No drawings.
We do sketches. Why? And Peter is an amazing drawer. And I used to do all the working drawings. But I also am quite tired of the kind of reification of the sketch. I think it's a kind of very nostalgic. And also, it's not like that's how architects used to design either. Some architects design that way. The way we work in the office, We use models a lot. We used to be very against perspectives, but actually now, because we draw everything in 3D in the computer, we're constantly drawing in 3D and rendering even for ourselves. But we do a lot of physical models, and we do a lot of talking, because at the beginning, nothing you showed actually, it was Peter and I in the office, sketching and talking, making models, doing the drawings, running the jobs, building the buildings, you know? But as soon as Walsall happened, we had an office with 6 or 7 people. And then you need to learn how to delegate that stuff. I also don't believe, because I know some people who do believe this, and I think they're deluded, that if you do everything yourself, you're controlling everything. I don't think that's the case. I think as soon as you're doing a project that's bigger than a house, you need more people, especially nowadays, because I think it's more complicated for all sorts of reasons to build a building. And you need to understand how to delegate, and you need to understand how to manage an office. You need to understand all of those things are important, and they've been important since the late 19th century. I don't think they were so important in the 15th century. It was different then. And, I think different architects work in different ways, you know. But I think it's amongst some people I know, there's this thing about the sketch and the sketchbook. And I think now, in a digital time, like, I'm a teacher. Yeah, I've always taught. And I really am not interested in seeing my students' sketches at all, because I know that my own sketches are dubious enough. My students' sketches are beyond dubious. So I only look at work that is in some way finished. So it's a model, or they've sat down and prepared a set of finished drawings, and then we can talk about it. And actually, and it's not just now, for the last 15 years or more, I think young architects, some of them might sketch, but some sketch using the computer. And I think it doesn't matter. It's not better to do it by hand or on the computer. Like my son, who's in art school, who loves drawing, and he draws a lot by hand. But for him, drawing, and he's now into analog photography, but then digital media, they're all the same thing. And he uses them seamlessly. And it's all of these things are just full of potential. Of course, I think one can make beautiful drawings, and I'm interested in etching, and I'm interested in all of those things. But, in our office now, we also we've had for years a Zund cutter, which is a very expensive Swiss machine, which cuts board and thin materials with a knife, which is driven by the computer. We have 3D printers also, and they're all good, these things, And we have all sorts of software, which is about designing, which is about working with other consultants, and which is about working with manufacturing. I'm not nostalgic about anything. I mean, when I taught at Bath, I was professor at Bath years ago, and Bath was a bit of a low ebb. I banned hand drawing because I said, my God, the school looks like it's like in a bad version of, 19th century. Like, why did you want the school to be that? Come on, I'm not interested, But of course, sometimes you get students who are amazing drawers and it's productive for them, and then that's great, I'd it's not that I'm against that. But all of these things are available, and I think, you use you use every means that's at your disposal. You see what it's worth, and then you use some of them and you reject others and you find a way, and it's always changing.
Is there a particular value to real models?
I mean, the models you're showing. Okay, so the Nagel House, that's a full-scale model of something which unfortunately didn't get built. It's a project we were doing with Thomas de Mand in Zurich, and there was a referendum, and we lost by 0.1%. And that's enough to lose by. It's like a referendum. And then on the other side, those are models we made for an exhibition, and they're very abstracted. And they were made actually by students of mine in Zurich during the summer. And they're painted in a very particular way. But we use models because, I think you can make a big model, you can look at it from different points of view. I mean, we use them for presentations a lot for a 10-year period. But now when we do competitions for big city projects, whether they're for the city or for developers, it's not possible. If you don't do a rendering, they think you're an amateur. So it's just not possible. You have to do renderings. I regret that because I think there's a problem with renderings. So we do try to do the best renderings we can. And it's a sales thing in a way because I don't think a rendering, I mean, we use these white renderings in the office, which are really fast, and we found a way to do them so they're really, really useful. But a rendering that you do for a competition or a presentation, that's a different thing. And, yeah, that's something that the kind of market is insisting on. Mm. And I don't find it that interesting. Although there's a few people now doing renderings which are pretty amazing. There's this firm in Paris, which is, they're using animation software. Do you know them? I'll show you. They're really quite extraordinary. So even something like a rendering, which I'm suspicious about, has a potential to show you something that you weren't aware of. Yeah. But I do occasionally sketch things. But we never show our sketches because we're just not... And we used to throw them away. We keep them now. So, you know, eventually in the Caruso St. John archive, you'll get to see them.
Late sketches.
No, I know you weren't... But there is a discourse at the moment that I don't know if people are aware of about sketches and sketchbooks and stuff. And I think it's easy that it becomes a kind of fiction, you know.
I have a comment followed by a question, if I may. You mentioned Gottfried Semper, and I think this building has a real... It was a real privilege to bring young people to this building and its interplay of tectonics and how playful the surfaces are. And I was able to get young people to literally touch the building as having a journey through it. And that was a really wonderful way to explore it. But as a question, thinking about Semper again and the idea of maybe the hearth being the heart of the home, and it might be odd to place a domestic narrative on a public space, but if you were to think of the heart of this space, where would it be?
Of the building?
Mm.
I mean, Semper wouldn't, you know, Semper did a lot of public buildings and they don't have hearths, just to be clear. And unlike Walsall, we never called this building a big house. I don't remember what we called it, but it was never house-like. I think this room, in a strange way, is the thing lurking at the core of the building. Our idea for this space was that it would be like a found space. And I think, I don't know if people think this, but we always thought it would be as if there had been this weird storage space built into the caves of the site and that we'd built the rest of the building around it. And there's this huge structure which doesn't really appear, it sort of appears out there, but it's really big, and it's supporting the structure of the galleries upstairs. But it's not like a hearth, because it's not necessarily cozy, this space. It's kind of, it could be menacing, but it is the biggest space, and it's the kind of the space which has events like this, which are kind of collective and social. I remember at the opening weekend, it was quite shocking in a really good way, but they had all sorts of education things happening here. And they also had the kind of animals dressed up as the kind of zebra logo of the Nottingham Contemporary. And I remember looking down the window on my way down. It was the morning after the opening. And I looked down, and it was like a school gym, you know? And I'd never, ever thought that this space was like a school gym. It was the only thing I never thought it was like. But it was exactly like a school gym. And Alex and the team, you know, they'd obviously also thought it was a bit like that, and that you could have this kind of a bit village fate sort of event happening in it indoors. And it was nice, you know, that they'd already hacked the building on the first day it was open to the public. For me, it's like it shows it's a strength of the building that it can, that you can do that to it. But I don't know, it doesn't really have a center of the building because it has all these different, like it has two entrances that, okay, they don't actually, but they kind of, in terms of the building, have an equivalence. You know, one is into the galleries and one is into the cafe. And the windows around it all look into different spaces, like they look into the offices, they look into the conference room of the offices, into the cafe, into the galleries. It's actually quite a building that's looking out. And it was always an idea that the upper galleries were totally different than the lower spaces. Like the lower spaces are concrete and they're built into the ground, and the upper galleries are steel and they're sitting on the concrete building, and then they're clad in this kind of curtain of concrete. So it kind of doesn't have really a center. But I guess this is the geographical center, you know.
Adam, you mentioned in passing that New York-based artists of the late 60s, early 70s, people like Richard Serra, Robert Smithson, were important for you early on. And I guess what I took you to mean by that was the ways in which that generation of artists were using loft spaces and so on. It's been for some time now that that kind of loft look or found warehouse or, you know, formerly industrial spaces has been the kind of paradigmatic one for museums of modern contemporary art. I guess my question is, do you see that as continuing? And are there architects out there, younger or older, who are designing museums that you particularly admire, and are they shifting from that paradigm?
That wasn't the influence of them. Their influence was their work. You know, and so, for instance, one of the first exhibitions we had, we used Sarah's list of verbs as a kind of structuring instrument for the show. And it was things like Smithson's mirror displacements, which, you know, we explicitly used in early projects. So it actually wasn't the loft thing. I mean, we've always been interested in the idea of found spaces, and that there's certain buildings that are very different than contemporary buildings that have a capacity to be used in lots of different ways. But it wasn't just industrial buildings, because maybe the reference we've used on more competitions than any other is a plan of a monastery, because a monastery is a kind of microcosm of society, and you have big spaces and cells, and you have indoor and outdoor spaces. And so it actually was their practice that was the influence. But your question is nonetheless very interesting. I don't know. You know, I don't think that the loft is the only kind of space. You know, I think 19th century enfilade galleries are really good. I think there's lots of models. We're now working on a quite radical restructuring of a 70s building in Munich, the Neue Pinakothek, which is a kind of weird combination of postmodern and structuralist building. Very, very good galleries with 18th and 19th century art in it. And it's very interesting to work in that building. And we're making some new art spaces, and some spaces in the building were terrible, but most of them are really good. But, you know, a lot of museums are done by architects who are very rhetorical, like OMA, for instance. We were talking before the lecture about, you were talking about, Ellen van Loon. And, you know, I think the museums that they're doing are, I mean, I think Prada, the Fondation Prada, is a really interesting institution. I think some of the spaces are really silly, but I think Prada is an amazing collector, and she facilitates an amazing program. And so I think it's really interesting. But, you know, do I think that the new gallery building in the middle is good? I think it's perverse. And I'm not sure that that's good. And I think within the context of the Fondation Prada, it works, because she can do whatever she wants and she can sustain. You know, I mean, they were going to work in a certain way. Kulas and Monsieur Prada developed the project, because one of the senior curators there took my students around for 3 hours, and he said, and he's an architect, and he was saying, but it's impossible. We can't run the museum this way. But they built it, and then they had to completely reverse the way the institution worked. And it was better. It was a better idea. But the idea was that you would need a ticket to go into the territory of the Fondation, but then they organized it so that couldn't possibly work, because to go to the restaurant, you have to be in the territory, to go to the toilet, to go to anything. So what they said was that, no, you can go and it's free, and then they check it when you go into the galleries, like a big museum would be. So, but they were able to do that, you know, and a public institution is not able to completely reverse the way it works for all sorts of reasons. Financial is maybe the biggest reason. I don't know, you know, so I think there's a lot of museum projects being done by old, very rhetorical architects that I don't find them so interesting. And then I think there's also a lot of institutional conservatism at the moment. I think there should be institutions that are working in new ways. It's the thing I said earlier, like I think that the idea that the museum visitor is only a consumer is something that has to be challenged. Like I think we're getting into the end game of that. And there's some big museums in London that really are working that way. And I don't see the point in going into those museums anymore because the experience is so terrible. I'm not going to say which ones they are, but it's unbelievable. So I think there has to be this shift. And I think that the idea that the visitor becomes implicated in the production of art or in the interpretation of art, and I don't mean in a patronizing way, which people are talking about, and there's artists whose practice makes room for that already for the last 15 years. I think that that's really challenging. But unfortunately, that's happening at the same time where either public institutions are under a lot of financial pressure or they're just very, very conservative. You know, I don't know that MoMA is under financial pressure, but it's an incredibly conservative institution where, as far as I can tell, nothing interesting happens. And they're building lots of new galleries and there's nothing interesting about them. But, you know, it's super interesting. And we did a competition for the Citroën in Brussels recently, and Brussels is a place where that could really happen because there's a lot of amazing private collections that are not going to be given to public institutions because they don't exist yet. There's Wiels, this existing contemporary institution, which is very hardcore but keeps away from the center. There was this big competition, like really one of the big competitions of the last 5 years. We were one of the 7 teams. We didn't win. And I just read a review of the competition, and they identified that our scheme was the one that challenged how an institution could work, and not in a way that was expensive, but in the way that audience production exhibition would be challenged. And the Pompidou who are involved in the project, apparently they just said, this is impossible, we can't work with this project. I don't know why, because they could have. And the winner, which is by friends of mine, and it's a good scheme, but it's more conventional. It I don't think it challenged in that way. We did the project with 51 and friends of mine in Brussels and with Thomas Demand, and it was super interesting to talk about. Yeah, we were very explicit about how curatorial things and spatial things. It's a big existing factory, so it wasn't about really the architecture. I'm super interested in it, but at the moment, and I think with exhibitions one can explore that, and I really enjoy it. Like we're doing one show, and I made a proposal, and the curators almost fell off their seats, and then they've totally reformulated the structure of the show now because they think it was a really good idea, you know? And so you can challenge it in a show, I think, but in a building, I'm not sure where that's happening. But I don't know everything that's going on either, you know? And, you know, it'd be really interesting to talk about that because it's interesting. But in the end, it's the institutional structure that's the most important. Like, I don't think the architecture is the thing. You know, I think you could run this institution in a totally different way and you could make it really bad, you know, but it's not, it's really good. And I think, to me, it's the institutional structure that's the most important. That's maybe enough. Oh, no.
What drew you towards architecture?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, we need an hour for that, no? But a very short answer. My father's an architect, so I grew up knowing only one thing, that I never wanted to be an architect because it's such a difficult job. And I was accepted into a pre-med program and I went to university because my family wanted me to be a doctor. That was good. And I was very good at sciences. And I remember the first week of university, they had a kind of freshers thing and I saw all the other courses that were available, like art history and film, and I said, I'm not just going to continue doing sciences, that's crazy. So I had this weird course of study where I continued enough sciences to do the pre-med part, but I took film and I took art history as well. And then in the second year I transferred to art history. And so then I thought, at the end of art history, I thought, well, I'll be an architectural historian. So then I went to architecture school, but I'm not going to practice. And then by second year, I'd forgotten about that. But my father gave me some very good advice about things that one could do to mitigate against the kind of extremes that he'd experienced as an architect in Montreal, where it's quite difficult. And it was amazingly good advice. And I was able to follow it, you know. And like one thing was to teach, you know, that to be an academic and a practitioner. And Peter and I always have done that. And it's not only in order that you have that to sustain you on fallow periods in your practice, it's also that it keeps you curious and challenged, you know. And so, I mean, I've only not taught for 2 years in the last 28 years, and I felt guilty. It was a good break, but I felt guilty. Because if you've taught for so long, you feel that that's actually part of your job. You have to be teaching. So that's how I became an architect. But my son definitely doesn't want to be an architect. My wife is an architect too. But she's a writer. She doesn't practice.
What sort of advice would you give to someone who's interested in being an architect in the future?
It's so hard now to be an architect, you know, but it's an amazing, you know, to me the most, and I must say the last 2 years have been so difficult that I feel a bit jaded, but the most amazing thing about being an architect is that you can engage in a deeper way with the environment around you. To me, that's the most amazing thing. One's education as an architect, and if one really takes history and the cultural part of architecture as well as designing and the technical parts of architecture seriously, and if you're at a school where those things are offered, I think, to me, that's the greatest privilege, is that you really can engage in a kind of in a deeper way with the situations that practice push you into. So like the physical context of your practice, but the social context, working with clients, great ones, bad ones, you learn from all of those situations, you know. It makes you, and I think contemporary art is the same, but contemporary artists, I guess they can work in a more insulated, they have to sometimes, in a more insulated context, but that's why, you know, I think contemporary artists are so incredibly important, because I think they also engage with our life in a very deep way, and then their work tells us something about our condition and where we live, and they show us ways of looking at things that, you know, make things a bit better. I think art production and architecture, you know, the only reason you do it is to make things a bit better. Not politically, I don't think we're politicians, but just that you can touch people, and it's like a little nudge about what's possible. That, you know, that is special. And so when I am in a city or even in a landscape, I feel that I have a privileged way of looking at things because of this huge library of stuff in my head. You know, and I think you can't just do the education, that's it. I think practice, you know, if you manage to have a particular kind of practice, you continue learning. It's a kind of job where you can continue learning, or it's a vocation, I guess. And I guess the people in my office, in our office, they like being in it because we're not jaded. You know, that all the projects mean something to us, and that's very clear. And we're not doing them to be rich or to buy another Porsche. I don't have any Porsches. So we're doing it because we're kind of engaged somehow in it. But it's not easy, you know, and it's getting hard. It is definitely getting harder because architecture is also very close to the economy and to capitalism. And we're in this end game now, I think. We really are. And sometimes I wonder if it's possible to practice architecture anymore. Like, it is quite difficult. But, you know, we have to live in hope. Yeah. On that note, we can maybe stop. It's pretty hard to be an artist, too, now.
Yeah.
You know, with the market breathing down your...
Yeah, I mean, there's always podcasting.
Yeah, you can retire to the world of podcasts.
Yes, great.
And well, it's incredibly profitable as well.
Yeah. Wait till you see our Porsches. Well, thank you all very much for coming. It's been great.
That was very good, huh? Well done.
Yeah.
Oh, we missed lots of stuff. Oh,
no, well, but we don't.
Maybe we can talk about it on the train.
Well done for making it through all that.
Yeah. Seems a bit different.
Yes. Pretty minimally edited.
We had a lot of thoughts about this.
Yeah.
And we've put them into the other thing.
Yeah. So there should be another podcast coming out around the same time as this, in which we'll go through our thoughts on how the whole thing went. So you can catch up with us there. Thanks very much for listening. Remember, you can support our Patreon at patreon.com/about_buildings and follow us on social media at @about_buildings. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks a ton. And yes. Bye-bye.
And bye. Okay. And then...